Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Chapter 11 of Little Lord Fauntleroy. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Susan Umpleby. Little Lord Fauntleroy by Francis Hodgson Burnett. Chapter 11. When Mr. Hobbs's young friend left him to go to Dorincourt Castle and become Lord Fauntleroy, and the groceryman had time to realize that the Atlantic Ocean lay between himself and the small companion who had spent so many agreeable hours in his society, he really began to feel very lonely indeed. The fact was, Mr. Hobbs was not a clever man, nor even a bright one. He was indeed rather a slow and heavy person, and he had never made many acquaintances. He was not mentally energetic enough to know how to amuse himself. And in truth, he never did anything of an entertaining nature but read the newspapers and add up his accounts. It was not very easy for him to add up his accounts, and sometimes it took him a long time to bring them out right. And in the old days, little Lord Fauntleroy, who had learned how to add up quite nicely with his fingers and a slate and pencil, had sometimes even gone to the length of trying to help him. And then, too, he had been so good a listener, and had taken such an interest in what the newspaper said, and he and Mr. Hobbs had held such long conversations about the Revolution and the British and the elections and the Republican Party, that it was no wonder his going left a blank in the grocery store. At first it seemed to Mr. Hobbs that Cedric was not really far away, and would come back again, that some day he would look up from his paper and see the little lad standing in the doorway, in his white suit and red stockings, and with his straw hat on the back of his head, and would hear him say in his cheerful little voice, "Hello, Mr. Hobbs! This is a hot day, isn't it?" But as the days passed on and this did not happen, Mr. Hobbs felt very dull and uneasy. He did not even enjoy his newspaper as much as he used to. He would put the paper down on his knee after reading it and sit and stare at the high stool for a long time. There were some marks on the long legs which made him feel quite dejected and melancholy. They were marks made by the heels of the next Earl of Dorincourt, when he kicked and talked at the same time. It seems that even youthful earls kick the legs of things they sit on. Noble blood and lofty lineage do not prevent it. After looking at those marks, Mr. Hobbs would take out his gold watch and open it and stare at the inscription. From his oldest friend, Lord Fauntleroy, to Mr. Hobbs, "When this you see, remember me." And after staring at it a while, he would shut it up with a loud snap and sigh and get up and go and stand in the doorway, between the box of potatoes and the barrel of apples, and look up the street. At night, when the store was closed, he would light his pipe and walk slowly along the pavement until he reached the house where Cedric had lived, on which there was a sign that read, "This house to let," and he would stop near it and look up and shake his head and puff at his pipe very hard, and after a while walk mournfully back again. This went on for 2 or 3 weeks before any new idea came to him. Being slow and ponderous, it always took him a long time to reach a new idea. As a rule, he did not like new ideas, but preferred old ones. After 2 or 3 weeks, however, during which, instead of getting better, matters really grew worse, a novel plan slowly and deliberately dawned upon him. He would go to see Dick. He smoked a great many pipes before he arrived at the conclusion, but finally he did arrive at it. He would go to see Dick. He knew all about Dick. Cedric had told him. And his idea was that perhaps Dick might be some comfort to him in the way of talking things over. So one day, when Dick was very hard at work blacking a customer's boots, A short, stout man with a heavy face and a bald head stopped on the pavement and stared for 2 or 3 minutes at the bootblack sign, which read, "Professor Dick Tipton can't be beat." He stared at it so long that Dick began to take a lively interest in him. And when he had put the finishing touch to his customer's boots, he said, "Want a shine, sir?" The stout man came forward deliberately and put his foot on the rest. "Yes," he said. Then, when Dick fell to work, the stout man looked from Dick to the sign, and from the sign to Dick. "Where did you get that?" he asked. "From a friend of mine," said Dick, "a little feller. He gov me the whole outfit. He was the best little feller ye ever saw. He's in England now, gone to be one of them lords."
Lord, asked Mr. Hobbs with ponderous slowness. "Lord Fauntleroy? Going to be Earl of Dorincourt?"
Dick almost dropped his brush. "Why, boss," he exclaimed, "do you know him yourself?"
"I've known him," answered Mr. Hobbs, wiping his warm forehead, "ever since he was born. We was lifetime acquaintances. That's what we was."
It really made him feel quite agitated to speak of it. He pulled the splendid gold watch out of his pocket and opened it, and showed the inside of the case to Dick.
"When this you see, remember me," he read. "That was his parting keepsake to me. I don't want you to forget me." Those was his words. "I'd have remembered him," he went on, shaking his head, "if he hadn't given me a thing, and I hadn't seen hide nor hair on him again. He was a companion as any man would remember."
"He was the nicest little feller I ever see," said Dick. "And as to sand, I never seen so much sand to a little feller. I thought a heap of him, I did. And we was friends, too. We was sort of chums from the fust, that little young'un and me. I grabbed his ball from under a stage for him, and he never forgot it. And he'd come down here, he would, with his mother or his nurse, and he'd holler, 'Hello, Dick,' at me, as friendly as if he was 6 feet high, when he warn't knee-high to a grasshopper, and was dressed in gal's clothes. He was a gay little chap, and when you was down on your luck, it did you good to talk to him."
"That's so," said Mr. Hobbs. "It was a pity to make an earl out of him. He would have shone in the grocery business, or dry goods either. He would have shone." And he shook his head with deeper regret than ever.
It proved that they had so much to say to each other that it was not possible to say it all at one time. And so it was agreed that the next night Dick should make a visit to the store and keep Mr. Hobbs company. The plan pleased Dick well enough. He had been a street waif nearly all his life, but he had never been a bad boy, and he had always had a private yearning for a more respectable kind of existence. Since he had been in business for himself, he had made enough money to enable him to sleep under a roof instead of out in the streets, and he had begun to hope he might reach even a higher plane in time. So, to be invited to call on a stout, respectable man who owned a corner store and even had a horse and wagon seemed to him quite an event.
"Do you know anything about earls and castles?" Mr. Hobbs inquired. "I'd like to know more of the particulars." "There's a story about some of 'em in the Penny Story Gazette," said Dick. "It's called 'The Crime of a Coronet, or The Revenge of the Countess May.' It's a boss thing, too. Some of us boys are taking it to read."
"Bring it up when you come," said Mr. Hobbs, "and I'll pay for it. Bring all you can find that have any earls in 'em. If there aren't earls, marquises'll do, or dukes. Though he never made mention of any dukes or marquises. We did go over coronets a little, but I never happened to see any. I guess they don't keep 'em round here."
"Tiffany'd have 'em if anybody did," said Dick. "But I don't know as I'd know one if I saw it."
Mr. Hobbs did not explain that he would not have known one if he saw it. He merely shook his head ponderously.
"I suppose there's very little call for 'em," he said, and that ended the matter.
This was the beginning of quite a substantial friendship. When Dick went up to the store, Mr. Hobbs received him with great hospitality. He gave him a chair tilted against the door near a barrel of apples, and after his young visitor was seated, he made a jerk at them with the hand in which he held his pipe, saying, "Help yourself." Then he looked at the story papers, and after that they read and discussed the British aristocracy. And Mr. Hobbs smoked his pipe very hard and shook his head a great deal. He shook it most when he pointed out the high stool with the marks on its legs. "There's his very kicks," he said impressively. "His very kicks. I sit and look at 'em by the hour. This is a world of ups and it's a world of downs. Why, he'd set there and eat crackers out of a box and apples out of a barrel and pitch his cores into the street. And now he's a lord a-living in a castle. Them's a lord's kicks. There'll be an earl's kick some day. Sometimes I says to myself, says I, well, I'll be jiggered." He seemed to derive a great deal of comfort from his reflections and Dick's visit. Before Dick went home, they had a supper in the small back room. They had crackers and cheese and sardines and other canned things out of the store. And Mr. Hobbs solemnly opened two bottles of ginger ale and, pouring out two glasses, proposed a toast. "Here's to him," he said, lifting his glass, "and may he teach him a lesson, earls and marquises and dukes and all." After that night, the two saw each other often, and Mr. Hobbs was much more comfortable and less desolate. They read the Penny Story Gazette and many other interesting things, and gained a knowledge of the habits of the nobility and gentry, which would have surprised those despised classes if they had realized it. One day, Mr. Hobbs made a pilgrimage to a bookstore downtown for the express purpose of adding to their library. He went to the clerk and leaned over the counter to speak to him. "I want," he said, "a book about earls." "What?" exclaimed the clerk. "A book," repeated the grocery man. "About earls." "I'm afraid," said the clerk, looking rather queer, "that we haven't what you want." "Haven't?" said Mr. Hobbs anxiously. "Well, say marquises, then, or dukes." "I know of no such book," answered the clerk. Mr. Hobbs was much disturbed. He looked down on the floor. Then he looked up. "None about female earls?" he inquired. "I'm afraid not," said the clerk with a smile. "Well," exclaimed Mr. Hobbs, "I'll be jiggered." He was just going out of the store when the clerk called him back and asked him if a story in which the nobility were chief characters would do. Mr. Hobbs said it would, if he could not get an entire volume devoted to earls. So the clerk sold him a book called The Tower of London, written by Mr. Harrison Ainsworth, and he carried it home. When Dick came, they began to read it. It was a very wonderful and exciting book, and the scene was laid in the reign of the famous English queen who is called by some people Bloody Mary. And as Mr. Hobbs heard of Queen Mary's deeds and the habit she had of chopping people's heads off, putting them to the torture, and burning them alive, he became very much excited. He took his pipe out of his mouth and stared at Dick, and at last he was obliged to mop the perspiration from his brow with his red pocket-handkerchief. "Why, he ain't safe," he said. "He ain't safe. If the women folks can sit up on their thrones and give the word for things like that to be done, who's to know what's happening to him this very minute? He's no more safe than nothing. Just let a woman like that get mad, and no one's safe." "Well," said Dick, though he looked rather anxious himself, "you see, this here un isn't the one that's bossin' things now. I know her name's Victory, and this un here in the book, her name's Mary." "So it is," said Mr. Hobbs, still mopping his forehead. "So it is. And the newspapers are not saying anything about any racks, thumbscrews, or stake burnin's. But still, it doesn't seem as if it was safe for him over there with those queer folks. Why, they tell me they don't keep the 4th of July." He was privately uneasy for several days, and it was not until he received Fauntleroy's letter and had read it several times, both to himself and to Dick, and had also read the letter Dick got about the same time, that he became composed again. But they both found great pleasure in their letters, They read and reread them, and talked them over, and enjoyed every word of them. And they spent days over the answers they sent, and read them over almost as often as the letters they had received. It was rather a labor for Dick to write his. All his knowledge of reading and writing he had gained during a few months when he had lived with his elder brother and had gone to a night school. But, being a sharp boy, he had made the most of that brief education and had spelled out things in newspapers since then and practiced writing with bits of chalk on pavements or walls or fences. He told Mr. Hobbs all about his life and about his elder brother, who had been rather good to him after their mother died, when Dick was quite a little fellow. Their father had died some time before. The brother's name was Ben, and he had taken care of Dick as well as he could, until the boy was old enough to sell newspapers and run errands. They had lived together, and as he grew older, Ben had managed to get along until he had quite a decent place in a store. "And then," exclaimed Dick with disgust, "blessed if he didn't go and marry a gal. Just went and got spoony and hadn't any more sense left. Married her and set up housekeeping in two back rooms. And a hefty un she was, a regular tiger cat. She'd tear things to pieces when she got mad, and she was mad all the time. Had a baby just like her, yelled day and night. And if I didn't have to tend it, and when it screamed, she'd fire things at me. She fired a plate at me one day and hit the baby, cut its chin. Doctor said he'd carry the mark till he died. A nice mother she was, cracky. But didn't we have a time, Ben and myself and the young un? She was mad at Ben because he didn't make money faster, and at last he went out west with a man to set up a cattle ranch. And hadn't been gone a week, for one night I got home from selling my papers and the rooms was locked up and empty. And the woman of the house, she told me Minna'd gone. Shown a clean pair of heels. Someone else said she'd gone across the water to be a nurse to a lady as had a little baby, too. Never heard a word of her since. Nuther has been. If I'd have been him, I wouldn't have fretted a bit, and I guess he didn't. But he thought a heap of her at the start. Tell you, he was spoons on her. She was a daisy-looking gal, too, when she was dressed up and not mad. She'd big black eyes and black hair down to her knees. She'd make it into a rope as big as your arm and twist it round and round her head, and I tell you, her eyes'd snap. Folks used to say she was part Italian, said her mother or father'd come from there, and it made her queer. I tell you, she was one of 'em, she was." He often told Mr. Hobbs stories of her and of his brother Ben, who, since his going out west, had written once or twice to Dick. Ben's luck had not been good, and he had wandered from place to place, but at last he had settled on a ranch in California, where he was at work at the time when Dick became acquainted with Mr. Hobbs. "That gal," said Dick one day, "she took all the grit out of him. I couldn't help feeling sorry for him sometimes." They were sitting in the store doorway together, and Mr. Hobbs was filling his pipe. "He oughtn't to have married," he said solemnly, as he rose to get a match. "Women. I never could see any use in 'em myself." As he took the match from its box, he stopped and looked down on the counter. "Why," he said, "if here isn't a letter. I didn't see it before. The postman must have laid it down when I wasn't noticing, or the newspaper slipped over it." He picked it up and looked at it carefully. "It's from him," he exclaimed. "That's the very one it's from." He forgot his pipe altogether. He went back to his chair quite excited and took his pocket knife and opened the envelope. "I wonder what news there is this time," he said. And then he unfolded the letter and read as follows. "Dorincourt Castle. My dear Mr. Hobbs, I write this in a great hurry because I have something curious to tell you. I know you will be very much surprised, my dear friend, when I tell you. It's all a mistake, and I am not a lord, and I shall not have to be an earl. There is a lady which was married to my Uncle Bevis, who is dead, and she has a little boy, and he is Lord Fauntleroy, because that is the way it is in England. The earl's eldest son's little boy is the earl if everybody else is dead.
I mean if his father and grandfather are dead. My grandfather is not dead, but my Uncle Bevis is, and so his boy is Lord Fauntleroy, and I am not, because my papa was the youngest son, and my name is Cedric Errol like it was when I was in New York, and all the things will belong to the other boy. I thought at first I should have to give him my pony and cart, but my grandfather says I need not. My grandfather is very sorry, and I think he does not like the lady, but perhaps he thinks Dearest and I are sorry because I shall not be an earl. I would like to be an earl now, better than I thought I would at first, because this is a beautiful castle, and I like everybody so, and when you are rich, you can do so many things. I am not rich now, because when your papa is only the youngest son, he is not very rich. I am going to learn to work so that I can take care of Dearest. I have been asking Wilkins about grooming horses. Perhaps I might be a groom or a coachman. The lady brought her little boy to the castle, and my grandfather and Mr. Havisham talked to her. I think she was angry. She talked loud, and my grandfather was angry too. I never saw him angry before. I wish it did not make them all mad. I thought I should tell you and Dick right away, because you would be interested. So no more at present, with love from your old friend, Cedric Errol, not Lord Fauntleroy. Mr. Hobbs fell back in his chair. The letter dropped on his knee, and his penknife slipped to the floor, and so did the envelope. "Well," he ejaculated, "I am jiggered." He was so dumbfounded that he actually changed his exclamation. It had always been his habit to say, "I will be jiggered." But this time he said, "I am jiggered." Perhaps he really was jiggered. There is no knowing. "Well," said Dick, "the whole thing's bust up, hasn't it?" "Bust," said Mr. Hobbs. "It's my opinion it's a put-up job of the British aristocrats to rob him of his rights because he's an American. They've had a spite agin us ever since the Revolution, and they're taking it out on him. I told you he wasn't safe, and see what's happened. Like as not, the whole government's got together to rob him of his lawful ownin's." He was very much agitated. He had not approved of the change in his young friend's circumstances at first, but lately he had become more reconciled to it, and, after the receipt of Cedric's letter, he had perhaps even felt some secret pride in his young friend's magnificence. He might not have a good opinion of earls, but he knew that even in America, money was considered rather an agreeable thing, and if all the wealth and grandeur were to go with the title, it must be rather hard to lose it. "They're trying to rob him," he said. "That's what they're doing. And folks that have money ought to look after him." And he kept Dick with him until quite a late hour to talk it over, and when that young man left, he went with him to the corner of the street. And on his way back, he stopped opposite the empty house for some time, staring at the "To Let" sign, and smoking his pipe in much disturbance of mind. End of chapter 11. Chapter 12 of Little Lord Fauntleroy. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Susan Umpleby. Little Lord Fauntleroy by Francis Hodgson Burnett. Chapter 12. A very few days after the dinner party at the castle, almost everybody in England who read the newspapers at all knew the romantic story of what had happened at Dorincourt. It made a very interesting story when it was told with all the details. There was the little American boy who had been brought to England to be Lord Fauntleroy, and who was said to be so fine and handsome a little fellow, and to have already made people fond of him. There was the old earl, his grandfather, who was so proud of his heir. There was the pretty young mother who had never been forgiven for marrying Captain Errol. And there was the strange marriage of Bevis, the dead Lord Fauntleroy, and the strange wife, of whom no one knew anything, suddenly appearing with her son and saying that he was the real Lord Fauntleroy and must have his rights. All these things were talked about and written about and caused a tremendous sensation. And then there came the rumor that the Earl of Dorincourt was not satisfied with the turn affairs had taken, and would perhaps contest the claim by law, and the matter might end with a wonderful trial. There never had been such excitement before in the county in which Erleboro was situated. On market days, people stood in groups and talked and wondered what would be done. The farmers' wives invited one another to tea that they might tell one another all they had heard and all they thought and all they thought other people thought. They related wonderful anecdotes about the Earl's rage and his determination not to acknowledge the new Lord Fauntleroy and his hatred of the woman who was the claimant's mother. But, of course, it was Mrs. Dibble who could tell the most and who was more in demand than ever. "And a bad lookout it is," she said. "And if you were to ask me, ma'am, I should say that it was a judgment on him for the way he's treated that sweet young creature as he parted from her child. For he's got that fond of him, and that set on him, and that proud of him, as he's almost drove mad by what's happened. And what's more, this new one's no lady, as his little lordship's ma is. She's a bold-faced, black-eyed thing. As Mr. Thomas says, no gentleman in livery 'ud bemean himself to be gave orders by. And let her come into the house, he says, and he goes out of it. And the boy don't no more compare with the other one than nothing you could mention. And mercy knows what's going to come of it all, and where it's to end. And you might have knocked me down with a feather when Jane brought the news." In fact, there was excitement everywhere at the castle. In the library, where the Earl and Mr. Havisham sat and talked. In the servants' hall, where Mr. Thomas and the butler and the other men and women servants gossiped and exclaimed at all times of the day. And in the stables, where Wilkins went about his work in a quite depressed state of mind and groomed the brown pony more beautifully than ever, and said mournfully to the coachman that he "never taught a young gentleman to ride as took to it more natural, or was a better plucked one than he was. He was a one as it were some pleasure to ride behind." But in the midst of all the disturbance, there was one person who was quite calm and untroubled. That person was the little Lord Fauntleroy who was said not to be Lord Fauntleroy at all. When first the state of affairs had been explained to him, he had felt some little anxiousness and perplexity, it is true. But its foundation was not in baffled ambition. While the Earl told him what had happened, he had sat on a stool holding on to his knee, as he so often did when he was listening to anything interesting. And by the time the story was finished, he looked quite sober. "It makes me feel very queer," he said. "It makes me feel queer." The Earl looked at the boy in silence. It made him feel queer, too. Queerer than he had ever felt in his whole life. And he felt more queer still when he saw that there was a troubled expression on the small face, which was usually so happy. "Will they take Dearest's house from her, and her carriage?" Cedric asked in a rather unsteady, anxious little voice.
"No," said the Earl decidedly, in quite a loud voice, in fact. "They can take nothing from her."
"Oh," said Cedric, with evident relief. "Can't they?" Then he looked up at his grandfather, and there was a wistful shade in his eyes, and they looked very big and soft. "That other boy," he said rather tremulously, "he will have to be your boy now, as I was, won't he?"
"No," answered the Earl, and he said it so fiercely and loudly that Cedric quite jumped.
"No?" he exclaimed in wonderment. "Won't he? I thought..." He stood up from his stool quite suddenly. "Shall I be your boy, even if I'm not going to be an earl?" he said. "Shall I be your boy just as I was before?" And his flushed little face was all alight with eagerness. How the old earl did look at him from head to foot, to be sure! How his great shaggy brows did draw themselves together! And how queerly his deep eyes shone under them, how very queerly. "My boy," he said, and if you'll believe it,
His very voice was queer, almost shaky, and a little broken and hoarse. Not at all what you would expect an earl's voice to be, though he spoke more decidedly and peremptorily even than before.
"Yes, you'll be my boy as long as I live. And by George, sometimes I feel as if you were the only boy I had ever had."
Cedric's face turned red to the roots of his hair. It turned red with relief and pleasure. He put both his hands deep into his pockets and looked squarely into his noble relative's eyes.
"Do you?" he said. "Well, then, I don't care about the earl part at all. I don't care whether I'm an earl or not. I thought, you see, I thought the one that was going to be the earl would have to be your boy, too, and I couldn't be. That was what made me feel so queer."
The earl put his hand on his shoulder and drew him nearer.
"They shall take nothing from you that I can hold for you," he said, drawing his breath hard. "I won't believe yet that they can take anything from you. You were made for the place, and, well, you may fill it still. But whatever comes, you shall have all that I can give you. All."
It scarcely seemed as if he were speaking to a child, there was such determination in his face and voice. It was more as if he were making a promise to himself, and perhaps he was. He had never before known how deep a hold upon him his fondness for the boy and his pride in him had taken. He had never seen his strength and good qualities and beauty as he seemed to see them now. To his obstinate nature, it seemed impossible, more than impossible, to give up what he had so set his heart upon. And he had determined that he would not give it up without a fierce struggle. Within a few days after she had seen Mr. Havisham, the woman who claimed to be Lady Fauntleroy presented herself at the castle and brought her child with her. She was sent away. The earl would not see her, she was told by the footman at the door. His lawyer would attend to her case. It was Thomas who gave the message, and who expressed his opinion of her freely afterward in the servants' hall. He hoped, he said, as he had wore livery in high families long enough to know a lady when he see one, and if that was a lady, he was no judge of females. "The one at the lodge," added Thomas loftily, "'Merican or no American, she's one of the right sort, as any gentleman would recognize with all a eye. I remarked it myself to Henry when first we called there." The woman drove away, the look on her handsome, common face half frightened, half fierce. Mr. Havisham had noticed, during his interviews with her, that though she had a passionate temper and a coarse, insolent manner, she was neither so clever nor so bold as she meant to be. She seemed sometimes to be almost overwhelmed by the position in which she had placed herself. It was as if she had not expected to meet with such opposition. "She is evidently," the lawyer said to Mrs. Errol, "a person from the lower walks of life. She is uneducated and untrained in everything, and quite unused to meeting people like ourselves on any terms of equality. She does not know what to do. Her visit to the castle quite cowed her. She was infuriated, but she was cowed. The earl would not receive her, but I advised him to go with me to the Dorincourt Arms where she is staying. When she saw him enter the room, she turned white, though she flew into a rage at once, and threatened and demanded in one breath." The fact was that the earl had stalked into the room and stood, looking like a venerable aristocratic giant, staring at the woman from under his beetling brows, and not condescending a word. He simply stared at her, taking her in from head to foot as if she were some repulsive curiosity. He let her talk and demand until she was tired, without himself uttering a word, and then he said,
"You say you are my eldest son's wife. If that is true, and if the proof you offer is too much for us, the law is on your side. In that case, your boy is Lord Fauntleroy. The matter will be sifted to the bottom, you may rest assured. If your claims are proved, you will be provided for. I want to see nothing of either you or the child so long as I live. The place will unfortunately have enough of you after my death.
"You are exactly the kind of person I should have expected my son Bevis to choose."
And then he turned his back upon her and stalked out of the room as he had stalked into it. Not many days after that, a visitor was announced to Mrs. Errol, who was writing in her little morning room. The maid who brought the message looked rather excited. Her eyes were quite round with amazement, in fact, and being young and inexperienced, she regarded her mistress with nervous sympathy.
"It's the Earl hisself, ma'am," she said in tremulous awe.
When Mrs. Errol entered the drawing room, a very tall, majestic-looking old man was standing on the tiger-skin rug. He had a handsome, grim old face, with an aquiline profile, a long white mustache, and an obstinate look.
"Mrs. Errol, I believe," he said.
"Mrs. Errol," she answered.
"I am the Earl of Dorincourt," he said.
He paused a moment, almost unconsciously, to look into her uplifted eyes. They were so like the big, affectionate, childish eyes he had seen uplifted to his own so often every day during the last few months, that they gave him quite a curious sensation.
"The boy is very like you," he said abruptly.
"It has been often said so, my lord," she replied, "but I have been glad to think him like his father also."
As Lady Lorridaile had told him, her voice was very sweet, and her manner was very simple and dignified. She did not seem in the least troubled by his sudden coming.
"Yes," said the Earl, "he is like my son, too."
He put his hand up to his big white mustache and pulled it fiercely.
"Do you know," he said, "why I have come here?"
"I have seen Mr. Havisham," Mrs. Errol began, "and he has told me of the claims which have been made."
"I have come to tell you," said the Earl, "that they will be investigated and contested, if a contest can be made. I have come to tell you that the boy shall be defended with all the power of the law. His rights..."
The soft voice interrupted him.
"He must have nothing that is not his by right, even if the law can give it to him," she said.
"Unfortunately, the law cannot," said the Earl. "If it could, it should. This outrageous woman and her child!"
"Perhaps she cares for him as much as I care for Cedric, my lord," said little Mrs. Errol. "And if she was your eldest son's wife, her son is Lord Fauntleroy, and mine is not."
She was no more afraid of him than Cedric had been, and she looked at him just as Cedric would have looked, and he, having been an old tyrant all his life, was privately pleased by it. People so seldom dared to differ from him that there was an entertaining novelty in it.
"I suppose," he said, scowling slightly, "that you would much prefer that he should not be the Earl of Dorincourt."
Her fair young face flushed.
"It is a very magnificent thing to be the Earl of Dorincourt, my lord," she said. "I know that, but I care most that he should be what his father was, brave and just and true always."
"In striking contrast to what his grandfather was, eh?" said his lordship sardonically.
"I have not had the pleasure of knowing his grandfather," replied Mrs. Errol. "But I know my little boy believes..."
She stopped short a moment, looking quietly into his face, and then she added,
"I know that Cedric loves you."
"Would he have loved me," said the Earl dryly, "if you had told him why I did not receive you at the castle?"
"No," answered Mrs. Errol, "I think not. That was why I did not wish him to know."
"Well," said my lord brusquely, "there are few women who would not have told him."
He suddenly began to walk up and down the room, pulling his great mustache more violently than ever.
"Yes, he is fond of me," he said, "and I am fond of him. I can't say I ever was fond of anything before. I am fond of him. He pleased me from the first. I am an old man and was tired of my life. He has given me something to live for. I am proud of him. I was satisfied to think of his taking his place some day as the head of the family."
He came back and stood before Mrs. Errol.
"I am miserable," he said. "Miserable."
He looked as if he was. Even his pride could not keep his voice steady or his hands from shaking. For a moment it almost seemed as if his deep, fierce eyes had tears in them.
"Perhaps it is because I am miserable that I have come to you," he said, quite glaring down at her. "I used to hate you. I have been jealous of you. This wretched, disgraceful business has changed that. After seeing that repulsive woman who calls herself the wife of my son Bevis, I actually felt it would be a relief to look at you. I have been an obstinate old fool, and I suppose I have treated you badly. You are like the boy, and the boy is the first object in my life. I am miserable, and I came to you merely because you are like the boy, and he cares for you, and I care for him. Treat me as well as you can, for the boy's sake."
He said it all in his harsh voice, almost roughly, but somehow he seemed so broken down for the time that Mrs. Errol was touched to the heart. She got up and moved an armchair a little forward. "I wish you would sit down," she said in a soft, pretty, sympathetic way. "You have been so much troubled that you are very tired, and you need all your strength." It was just as new to him to be spoken to and cared for in that gentle, simple way as it was to be contradicted. He was reminded of the boy again, and he actually did as she asked him. Perhaps his disappointment and wretchedness were good discipline for him. If he had not been wretched, he might have continued to hate her, but just at present he found her a little soothing. Almost anything would have seemed pleasant by contrast with Lady Fauntleroy. And this one had so sweet a face and voice, and a pretty dignity when she spoke or moved. Very soon, through the quiet magic of these influences, he began to feel less gloomy, and then he talked still more.
"Whatever happens," he said, "the boy shall be provided for. He shall be taken care of, now and in the future."
Before he went away, he glanced around the room.
"Do you like the house?" he demanded.
"Very much," she answered.
"This is a cheerful room," he said. "May I come here again and talk this matter over?"
"As often as you wish, my lord," she replied. And then he went out to his carriage and drove away, Thomas and Henry almost stricken dumb upon the box at the turn affairs had taken. End of chapter 12. Chapter 13 of Little Lord Fauntleroy. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Susan Umpleby. Little Lord Fauntleroy by Francis Hodgson Burnett. Chapter 13. Of course, as soon as the story of Lord Fauntleroy and the difficulties of the Earl of Dorincourt were discussed in the English newspapers, they were discussed in the American newspapers. The story was too interesting to be passed over lightly, and it was talked of a great deal. There were so many versions of it that it would have been an edifying thing to buy all the papers and compare them. Mr. Hobbs read so much about it that he became quite bewildered. One paper described his young friend Cedric as an infant in arms, another as a young man at Oxford, winning all the honors and distinguishing himself by writing Greek poems. One said he was engaged to a young lady of great beauty who was the daughter of a duke. Another said he had just been married. The only thing, in fact, which was not said was that he was a little boy between 7 and 8, with handsome legs and curly hair. One said he was no relation to the Earl of Dorincourt at all, but was a small impostor who had sold newspapers and slept in the streets of New York before his mother imposed upon the family lawyer, who came to America to look for the Earl's heir. Then came the descriptions of the new Lord Fauntleroy and his mother. Sometimes she was a gypsy, sometimes an actress, sometimes a beautiful Spaniard. But it was always agreed that the Earl of Dorincourt was her deadly enemy, and would not acknowledge her son as his heir if he could help it. and as there seemed to be some slight flaw in the papers she had produced, it was expected that there would be a long trial, which would be far more interesting than anything ever carried into court before. Mr. Hobbs used to read the papers until his head was in a whirl, and in the evening he and Dick would talk it all over. They found out what an important personage an Earl of Dorincourt was, and what a magnificent income he possessed, and how many estates he owned, and how stately and beautiful was the castle in which he lived. And the more they learned, the more excited they became.
"Seems like something ought to be done," said Mr. Hobbs. "Things like them are to be held on to, earls or no earls."
But there really was nothing they could do but each write a letter to Cedric, containing assurances of their friendship and sympathy. They wrote those letters as soon as they could after receiving the news. And after having written them, they handed them over to each other to be read. This is what Mr. Hobbs read in Dick's letter.
"Dear friend, I got your letter and Mr. Hobbs got his, and we are sorry you are down on your luck. And we say hold on as long's you can, and don't let no one get ahead of you. There is a lot of old thieves will make all they can of you if you don't keep your eye skinned. But this is mostly to say that I've not forgot what you did for me, and if there ain't no better way, come over here and go in partners with me. Business is fine, and I'll see no harm comes to you. Any big feller that tries to come it over you will have to settle it fust with Professor Dick Tipton, so no more at present. Dick." And this is what Dick read in Mr. Hobbs' letter. "Dear Sir, yours received and would say things look bad. I believe it's a put-up job, and them that's done it ought to be looked after sharp. And what I write to say is two things. I'm going to look this thing up. Keep quiet, and I'll see a lawyer and do all I can. And if the worst happens and them earls is too many for us, there's a partnership in the grocery business ready for you when you're old enough, and a home and a friend in. Yours truly, Silas Hobbs." "Well," said Mr. Hobbs, "he's provided for between us if he ain't an earl." "So he is," said Dick. "I'd have stood by him. Blessed if I didn't like that little feller fust rate."
The very next morning, one of Dick's customers was rather surprised. He was a young lawyer just beginning practice. As poor as a very young lawyer can possibly be, but a bright, energetic young fellow with sharp wit and a good temper. He had a shabby office near Dick's stand, and every morning Dick blacked his boots for him, and quite often they were not exactly watertight, but he always had a friendly word or a joke for Dick. That particular morning, when he put his foot on the rest, he had an illustrated paper in his hand, an enterprising paper with pictures in it of conspicuous people and things. He had just finished looking it over, and when the last boot was polished, he handed it over to the boy. "Here's a paper for you, Dick," he said. "You can look it over when you drop in at Delmonico's for your breakfast. Picture of an English castle in it, and an English earl's daughter-in-law. Fine young woman, too. Lots of hair, though she seems to be raising rather a row. You ought to become familiar with the nobility and gentry, Dick. Begin on the Right Honorable the Earl of Dorincourt and Lady Fauntleroy. Hello! I say, what's the matter?" The pictures he spoke of were on the front page, and Dick was staring at one of them with his eyes and mouth open and his sharp face almost pale with excitement. "What's to pay, Dick?" said the young man. "What has paralyzed you?" Dick really did look as if something tremendous had happened. He pointed to the picture, under which was written, "Mother of Claimant, Lady Fauntleroy." It was the picture of a handsome woman with large eyes and heavy braids of black hair wound around her head.
"Her!" said Dick. "My, I know her better'n I know you."
The young man began to laugh.
"Where did you meet her, Dick?" he said. "At Newport? Or when you ran over to Paris the last time?"
Dick actually forgot to grin. He began to gather his brushes and things together, as if he had something to do which would put an end to his business for the present.
"Never mind," he said. "I know her, and I've struck work for this morning."
and in less than 5 minutes from that time, he was tearing through the streets on his way to Mr. Hobbs and the corner store. Mr. Hobbs could scarcely believe the evidence of his senses when he looked across the counter and saw Dick rush in with a paper in his hand. The boy was out of breath with running, so much out of breath, in fact, that he could scarcely speak as he threw the paper down on the counter.
"Hello!" exclaimed Mr. Hobbs. "Hello! What you got there?"
"Look at it!" panted Dick. "Look at that woman in the picture! That's what you look at! She ain't no aristocrat, she ain't," with withering scorn. "She's no lord's wife. You may eat me if it ain't Minna. Minna! I'd know her anywheres, and so'd Ben. Just ax him."
Mr. Hobbs dropped into his seat.
"I knowed it was a put-up job," he said. "I knowed it. And they done it on account of him being American."
"Done it!" cried Dick with disgust. "She done it. That's who done it. She was allers up to her tricks. And I'll tell yer what come to me. The minute I saw her picture, there was one of them papers we saw had a letter in it that said something about her boy, and it said he had a scar on his chin. Put them two together, her and that there scar. Why, that there boy of hers ain't no more a lord than I am. It's Ben's boy. The little chap she hit when she let fly that plate at me."
Professor Dick Tipton had always been a sharp boy, and earning his living in the streets of a big city had made him still sharper. He had learned to keep his eyes open and his wits about him, and it must be confessed he enjoyed immensely the excitement and impatience of that moment. If little Lord Fauntleroy could only have looked into the store that morning, he would certainly have been interested, even if all the discussion and plans had been intended to decide the fate of some other boy than himself. Mr. Hobbs was almost overwhelmed by his sense of responsibility, and Dick was all alive and full of energy. He began to write a letter to Ben, and he cut out the picture and enclosed it to him. And Mr. Hobbs wrote a letter to Cedric and one to the Earl. They were in the midst of this letter writing when a new idea came to Dick.
"Say," he said, "the feller that give me the paper, he's a lawyer. Let's ax him what we better do. Lawyers knows it all."
Mr. Hobbs was immensely impressed by this suggestion and Dick's business capacity.
"That's so," he replied. "This here calls for lawyers."
And leaving the store in the care of a substitute, he struggled into his coat and marched downtown with Dick, and the two presented themselves with their romantic story in Mr. Harrison's office, much to that young man's astonishment. If he had not been a very young lawyer, with a very enterprising mind and a great deal of spare time on his hands, he might not have been so readily interested in what they had to say, for it all certainly sounded very wild and queer. But he chanced to want something to do very much, and he chanced to know Dick, and Dick chanced to say his say in a very sharp, telling sort of way.
"And," said Mr. Hobbs, "say what your time's worth a hour, and look into this thing thorough, and I'll pay the damage. Silas Hobbs, corner of Blank Street, vegetables and fancy groceries."
"Well," said Mr. Harrison, "it will be a big thing if it turns out all right, and it will be almost as big a thing for me as for Lord Fauntleroy. And at any rate, no harm can be done by investigating. It appears there has been some dubiousness about the child. The woman contradicted herself in some of her statements about his age and aroused suspicion. The first persons to be written to are Dick's brother and the Earl of Dorincourt's family lawyer." And actually, before the sun went down, two letters had been written and sent in two different directions, one speeding out of New York Harbor on a mail steamer on its way to England, and the other on a train carrying letters and passengers bound for California. And the first was addressed to T. Havisham, Esquire, and the second to Benjamin Tipton. And after the store was closed that evening, Mr. Hobbs and Dick sat in the back room and talked together until midnight. End of chapter 13. Chapter 14 of Little Lord Fauntleroy. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Susan Umpleby. Little Lord Fauntleroy by Francis Hodgson Burnett, Chapter 14. It is astonishing how short a time it takes for very wonderful things to happen. It had taken only a few minutes, apparently, to change all the fortunes of the little boy dangling his red legs from the high stool in Mr. Hobbs' store, and to transform him from a small boy living the simplest life in a quiet street into an English nobleman, the heir to an earldom and magnificent wealth. It had taken only a few minutes, apparently, to change him from an English nobleman into a penniless little impostor with no right to any of the splendors he had been enjoying. And surprising as it may appear, it did not take nearly so long a time as one might have expected to alter the face of everything again and to give back to him all he had been in danger of losing. It took the less time because, after all, the woman who had called herself Lady Fauntleroy was not nearly so clever as she was wicked, and when she had been closely pressed by Mr. Havisham's questions about her marriage and her boy, she had made one or two blunders which had caused suspicion to be awakened, and then she had lost her presence of mind and her temper, and in her excitement and anger had betrayed herself still further. All the mistakes she made were about her child. There seemed no doubt she had been married to Bevis, Lord Fauntleroy, and had quarreled with him and had been paid to keep away from him. But Mr. Havisham found out that her story of the boys being born in a certain part of London was false. And just when they all were in the midst of the commotion caused by this discovery, there came the letter from the young lawyer in New York, and Mr. Hobbs's letters also. What an evening it was when those letters arrived, and when Mr. Havisham and the Earl sat and talked their plans over in the library. "After my first three meetings with her," said Mr. Havisham, "I began to suspect her strongly. It appeared to me that the child was older than she said he was, and she made a slip in speaking of the date of his birth, and then tried to patch the matter up. The story these letters bring fits in with several of my suspicions. Our best plan will be to cable at once for these two Tiptons, say nothing about them to her, and suddenly confront her with them when she is not expecting it. She is only a very clumsy plotter, after all. My opinion is that she will be frightened out of her wits and will betray herself on the spot." And that was what actually happened. She was told nothing, and Mr. Havisham kept her from suspecting anything by continuing to have interviews with her, in which he assured her he was investigating her statements. And she really began to feel so secure that her spirits rose immensely, and she began to be as insolent as might have been expected. But one fine morning, as she sat in her sitting room at the inn called the Dorincourt Arms, making some very fine plans for herself, Mr. Havisham was announced, and when he entered, he was followed by no less than three persons. One was a sharp-faced boy, and one was a big young man, and the third was the Earl of Dorincourt. She sprang to her feet and actually uttered a cry of terror. It broke from her before she had time to check it. She had thought of these newcomers as being thousands of miles away, when she had ever thought of them at all, which she had scarcely done for years. She had never expected to see them again. It must be confessed that Dick grinned a little when he saw her. "Hello, Minna," he said. The big young man, who was Ben, stood still a minute and looked at her. "Do you know her?" Mr. Havisham asked, glancing from one to the other. "Yes," said Ben, "I know her, and she knows me." And he turned his back on her and went and stood looking out of the window, as if the sight of her was hateful to him, as indeed it was. Then the woman, seeing herself so baffled and exposed, lost all control over herself and flew into such a rage as Ben and Dick had often seen her in before. Dick grinned a trifle more as he watched her and heard the names she called them all and the violent threats she made, but Ben did not turn to look at her. "I can swear to her in any court," he said to Mr. Havisham, "and I can bring a dozen others who will. Her father is a respectable sort of man, though he's low down in the world.
Her mother was just like herself. She's dead, but he's alive, and he's honest enough to be ashamed of her. He'll tell you who she is and whether she married me or not." Then he clenched his hand suddenly and turned on her. "Where's the child?" he demanded. "He's going with me. He is done with you, and so am I." And just as he finished saying the words, the door leading into the bedroom opened a little, and the boy, probably attracted by the sound of the loud voices, looked in. He was not a handsome boy, but he had rather a nice face, and he was quite like Ben, his father, as anyone could see. And there was the three-cornered scar on his chin. Ben walked up to him and took his hand, and his own was trembling. "Yes," he said, "I could swear to him, too. Tom," he said to the little fellow, "I'm your father. I've come to take you away. Where's your hat?" The boy pointed to it where it lay on a chair. It evidently rather pleased him to hear that he was going away. He had been so accustomed to queer experiences that it did not surprise him to be told by a stranger that he was his father. He objected so much to the woman who had come a few months before to the place where he had lived since his babyhood, and who had suddenly announced that she was his mother, that he was quite ready for a change. Ben took up the hat and marched to the door. "If you want me again," he said to Mr. Havisham, "you know where to find me." He walked out of the room holding the child's hand and not looking at the woman once. She was fairly raving with fury, and the Earl was calmly gazing at her through his eyeglasses, which he had quietly placed upon his aristocratic eagle nose. "Come, come, my young woman," said Mr. Havisham. "This won't do at all. If you don't want to be locked up, you really must behave yourself." And there was something so very businesslike in his tones that, probably feeling that the safest thing she could do would be to get out of the way, she gave him one savage look and dashed past him into the next room and slammed the door. "We shall have no more trouble with her," said Mr. Havisham. And he was right, for that very night she left the Dorincourt Arms and took the train to London and was seen no more. When the Earl left the room after the interview, he went at once to his carriage. "To Court Lodge," he said to Thomas. "To Court Lodge," said Thomas to the coachman as he mounted the box. "And you may depend on it, things are taking an unexpected turn." When the carriage stopped at Court Lodge, Cedric was in the drawing room with his mother. The Earl came in without being announced. He looked an inch or so taller and a great many years younger. His deep eyes flashed. "Where," he said, "is Lord Fauntleroy?" Mrs. Errol came forward, a flush rising to her cheek. "Is it Lord Fauntleroy?" she asked. "Is it indeed?" The Earl put out his hand and grasped hers. "Yes," he answered, "it is." Then he put his other hand on Cedric's shoulder. "Fauntleroy," he said in his unceremonious, authoritative way, "ask your mother when she will come to us at the castle." Fauntleroy flung his arms around his mother's neck. "To live with us," he cried. "To live with us always." The Earl looked at Mrs. Errol, and Mrs. Errol looked at the Earl. His lordship was entirely in earnest. He had made up his mind to waste no time in arranging this matter. He had begun to think it would suit him to make friends with his heir's mother. "Are you quite sure you want me?" said Mrs. Errol with her soft, pretty smile.
"Quite sure," he said bluntly. "We have always wanted you, but we were not exactly aware of it. We hope you will come."
End of chapter 14. Chapter 15 of Little Lord Fauntleroy. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Susan Umpleby. Little Lord Fauntleroy by Francis Hodgson Burnett. Chapter 15. Ben took his boy and went back to his cattle ranch in California, and he returned under very comfortable circumstances. Just before his going, Mr. Havisham had an interview with him, in which the lawyer told him that the Earl of Dorincourt wished to do something for the boy who might have turned out to be Lord Fauntleroy, and so he had decided that it would be a good plan to invest in a cattle ranch of his own, and put Ben in charge of it on terms which would make it pay him very well, and which would lay a foundation for his son's future. And so, when Ben went away, he went as the prospective master of a ranch, which would be almost as good as his own, and might easily become his own in time, as indeed it did in the course of a few years. And Tom, the boy, grew up on it into a fine young man and was devotedly fond of his father. And they were so successful and happy that Ben used to say that Tom made up to him for all the troubles he had ever had. But Dick and Mr. Hobbs, who had actually come over with the others to see that things were properly looked after, did not return for some time. It had been decided at the outset that the Earl would provide for Dick and would see that he received a solid education. And Mr. Hobbs had decided that as he himself had left a reliable substitute in charge of his store, he could afford to wait to see the festivities which were to celebrate Lord Fauntleroy's 8th birthday. All the tenantry were invited, and there were to be feasting and dancing and games in the park, and bonfires and fireworks in the evening.
"Just like the 4th of July," said Lord Fauntleroy. "It seems a pity my birthday wasn't on the 4th, doesn't it? For then we could keep them both together."
It must be confessed that at first the Earl and Mr. Hobbs were not as intimate as it might have been hoped they would become, in the interests of the British aristocracy. The fact was that the Earl had known very few grocerymen, and Mr. Hobbs had not had many very close acquaintances who were earls, and so in their rare interviews conversation did not flourish. It must also be owned that Mr. Hobbs had been rather overwhelmed by the splendors Fauntleroy felt it his duty to show him. The entrance gate and the stone lions in the avenue impressed Mr. Hobbs somewhat at the beginning, and when he saw the castle and the flower gardens and the hothouses and the terraces and the peacocks and the dungeon and the armor and the great staircase and the stables and the liveried servants, he really was quite bewildered. But it was the picture gallery which seemed to be the finishing stroke.
"Something in the manner of a museum?" he said to Fauntleroy when he was led into the great, beautiful room.
No, said Fauntleroy rather doubtfully. "I don't think it's a museum. My grandfather says these are my ancestors."
"Your aunt's sisters?" ejaculated Mr. Hobbs. "All of them? Your great uncle, he must have had a family. Did he raise them all?"
And he sank into a seat and looked around him with quite an agitated countenance, until, with the greatest difficulty, Lord Fauntleroy managed to explain that the walls were not lined entirely with the portraits of the progeny of his great-uncle. He found it necessary, in fact, to call in the assistance of Mrs. Mellon, who knew all about the pictures, and could tell who painted them and when, and who added romantic stories of the lords and ladies who were the originals. When Mr. Hobbs once understood, and had heard some of these stories, he was very much fascinated and liked the picture gallery almost better than anything else. And he would often walk over from the village, where he stayed at the Dorincourt Arms, and would spend half an hour or so wandering about the gallery, staring at the painted ladies and gentlemen, who also stared at him, and shaking his head nearly all the time.
"And they was all earls," he would say, "or pretty nigh it. And he's going to be one of them, and own it all."
Privately, he was not nearly so much disgusted with earls and their mode of life as he had expected to be, and it is to be doubted whether his strictly republican principles were not shaken a little by a closer acquaintance with castles and ancestors and all the rest of it. At any rate, one day he uttered a very remarkable and unexpected sentiment.
"I wouldn't have minded being one of them myself," he said, which was really a great concession.
What a grand day it was when little Lord Fauntleroy's birthday arrived, and how his young lordship enjoyed it!
How beautiful the park looked, filled with the thronging people, dressed in their gayest and best, and with the flags flying from the tents and the top of the castle. Nobody had stayed away who could possibly come, because everybody was really glad that little Lord Fauntleroy was to be little Lord Fauntleroy still, and someday was to be the master of everything. Everyone wanted to have a look at him, and at his pretty, kind mother, who had made so many friends. And positively everyone liked the Earl rather better, and felt more amiably toward him because the little boy loved and trusted him so, and because also he had now made friends with and behaved respectfully to his heir's mother. It was said he was even beginning to be fond of her, too, and that between his young lordship and his young lordship's mother, the Earl might be changed in time into quite a well-behaved old nobleman, and everybody might be happier and better off. What scores and scores of people there were under the trees, and in the tents, and on the lawns. Farmers and farmers' wives, in their Sunday suits and bonnets and shawls. Girls and their sweethearts. Children frolicking and chasing about. And old dames in red cloaks gossiping together. At the castle there were ladies and gentlemen who had come to see the fun, and to congratulate the Earl, and to meet Mrs. Errol. Lady Lauradale and Sir Harry were there, and Sir Thomas Ashe and his daughters, and Mr. Havisham, of course, and then beautiful Miss Vivian Herbert, with the loveliest white gown and lace parasol, and a circle of gentlemen to take care of her, though she evidently liked Fauntleroy better than all of them put together. And when he saw her, and ran to her, and put his arm around her neck, she put her arms around him, too, and kissed him as warmly as if he had been her own favorite little brother, and she said, "Dear little Lord Fauntleroy, dear little boy, I am so glad, I am so glad." And afterwards she walked about the grounds with him and let him show her everything. And when he took her to where Mr. Hobbs and Dick were, and said to her, "This is my old, old friend Mr. Hobbs, Miss Herbert, and this is my other old friend Dick. I told them how pretty you were, and I told them they should see you if you came to my birthday." She shook hands with them both, and stood and talked to them in her prettiest way, asking them about America, and their voyage, and their life since they had been in England, while Fauntleroy stood by, looking up at her with adoring eyes, and his cheeks quite flushed with delight because he saw that Mr. Hobbs and Dick liked her so much. "Well," said Dick solemnly afterward, "she's the daisiest gal I ever saw. She's, well, she's just a daisy, that's what she is, and no mistake." Everybody looked after her as she passed, and everyone looked after little Lord Fauntleroy. And the sun shone, and the flags fluttered, and the games were played, and the dances danced. And as the gaieties went on, and the joyous afternoon passed, his little lordship was simply radiantly happy. The whole world seemed beautiful to him. There was someone else who was happy, too, an old man who, though he had been rich and noble all his life, had not often been very honestly happy. Perhaps, indeed, I shall tell you that I think it was because he was rather better than he had been that he was rather happier. He had not, indeed, suddenly become as good as Fauntleroy thought him, but at least he had begun to love something, and he had several times found a sort of pleasure in doing the kind things which the innocent, kind little heart of a child had suggested, and that was a beginning. And every day he had been more pleased with his son's wife. It was true, as the people said, that he was beginning to like her too. He liked to hear her sweet voice, and to see her sweet face, and as he sat in his armchair, he used to watch her and listen as she talked to her boy. And he heard loving, gentle words which were new to him, and he began to see why the little fellow who had lived in a New York side street and known groceryman and made friends with bootblacks was still so well-bred and manly a little fellow that he made no one ashamed of him, even when fortune changed him into the heir to an English earldom, living in an English castle. It was really a very simple thing, after all. It was only that he had lived near a kind and gentle heart, and had been taught to think kind thoughts always, and to care for others. It is a very little thing, perhaps, but it is the best thing of all. He knew nothing of earls and castles. He was quite ignorant of all grand and splendid things, but he was always lovable because he was simple and loving. To be so is like being born a king. As the old Earl of Dorincourt looked at him that day, moving about the park among the people, talking to those he knew, and making his ready little bow when anyone greeted him, entertaining his friends Dick and Mr. Hobbs, or standing near his mother or Miss Herbert, listening to their conversation, the old nobleman was very well satisfied with him. And he had never been better satisfied than he was when they went down to the biggest tent, where the more important tenants of the Dorincourt estate were sitting down to the grand collation of the day. They were drinking toasts, and after they had drunk the health of the Earl, with much more enthusiasm than his name had ever been greeted with before, they proposed the health of little Lord Fauntleroy. And if there had ever been any doubt at all as to whether his lordship was popular or not, it would have been set that instant. Such a clamor of voices, and such a rattle of glasses and applause! They had begun to like him so much, those warm-hearted people, that they forgot to feel any restraint before the ladies and gentlemen from the castle who had come to see them. They made quite a decent uproar, and one or two motherly women looked tenderly at the little fellow where he stood, with his mother on one side and the Earl on the other, and grew quite moist about the eyes, and said to one another, "God bless him, the pretty little dear!" Little Lord Fauntleroy was delighted. He stood and smiled, and made bows, and flushed rosy red with pleasure up to the roots of his bright hair. "Is it because they like me, dearest?" he said to his mother. "Is it, dearest? I'm so glad!" And then the Earl put his hand on the child's shoulder and said to him, "Fauntleroy, say to them that you thank them for their kindness." Fauntleroy gave a glance up at him, and then at his mother. "Must I?" he asked just a trifle shyly. And she smiled, and so did Miss Herbert, and they both nodded. And so he made a little step forward, and everybody looked at him. Such a beautiful, innocent little fellow he was, too, with his brave, trustful face. And he spoke as loudly as he could, his childish voice ringing out quite clear and strong. "I'm ever so much obliged to you," he said, "and I hope you'll enjoy my birthday, because I've enjoyed it so much, and I'm very glad I'm going to be an earl. I didn't think at first I should like it, but now I do. And I love this place so, and I think it is beautiful, and when I am an earl, I am going to try to be as good as my grandfather." And amid the shouts and clamor of applause, he stepped back with a little sigh of relief and put his hand into the Earl's and stood close to him, smiling and leaning against his side. And that would be the very end of my story. But I must add one curious piece of information, which is that Mr. Hobbs became so fascinated with high life and was so reluctant to leave his young friend that he actually sold his corner store in New York and settled in the English village of Earlsborough, where he opened a shop which was patronized by the castle and consequently was a great success. And though he and the Earl never became very intimate, if you will believe me, that man Hobbs became in time more aristocratic than his lordship himself, and he read the court news every morning and followed all the doings of the House of Lords. And about 10 years after, when Dick, who had finished his education and was going to visit his brother in California, asked the good grocer if he did not wish to return to America, he shook his head seriously. "Not to live there," he said. "Not to live there. I want to be near him and sort of look after him. It's a good enough country for them that's young and stirrin', but there's faults in it. There's not an aunt sister among them. Nor an earl." End of chapter 15. End of Little Lord Fauntleroy by Francis Hodgson Burnett.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.